From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. New questions are emerging today after the federal government revealed more information about which companies benefited from the $600 billion Paycheck Protection Program. People close to the president and other powerful politicians got some of those loans. We'll have more on that soon.
But first, COVID-19 continues to surge in parts of the country. Texas is one hot spot. The number of people hospitalized in that state has doubled in the last 2 weeks. In Houston, officials say hospitals are 1 or 2 weeks away from being totally overwhelmed. Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo joins us now. She's the chief executive for the county, which includes Houston and which has by far the most COVID cases in the state. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy.
Well, and we've been reading about hospitals close to reaching capacity, more than 80% full, not just running out of beds, but running out of healthy staff as well. They've been tightening the criteria for who gets admitted, which of course can be dangerous for the patients who have to be sent home. Now, you have said people should not wait to take drastic action. There should be another stay-at-home order now. Is anyone listening to you?
Yes and no. We had a stay-home order initially back in March, and folks worked together incredibly well. The community came together. We flattened the curve. And before we had a chance for the curve to come down on the other side to 10, 20% of peak, as it did in other communities and other nations, the state opened up. When they did that, they took away my authority to institute those kinds of orders. And so now all I can do is recommend. I've put the community on our level one threat alert, and the recommendation under that threat level is to stay home. Now, the sense we have is folks are, to some extent, listening, but obviously not to the degree that they would if this was an order, if this was a requirement. So that's why I've been advocating with the governor for that authority, or for him to do that within, you know, Harris County.
Well, and the governor did change his mind on masks, and he has now said that you have to wear a mask in Texas in counties where there's a certain number of cases. But what has he said to you about the idea of another stay-at-home order?
Ongoing conversation. We've been in contact throughout this whole process. Early on, when he first reopened, folks said, is this too fast? What do you think? My sense was always, it seems to me it's too fast, but we don't know for sure. Let's try and make it work. And right now, you know, the months have gone by, and what we've seen is that the communities that reopened later are the ones that aren't seeing this second resurgence. And if we just keep going the path we're going, eventually we're going to have to institute something of a stay-home order. And we put folks in a worse position economically if we don't have a sustainable coexisting relationship with the virus.
Now, a lot of people would point to the fact that the number of deaths in Harris County is just around 400, relatively low, considering the number of cases. Just by comparison, New York City has had more than 18,000 deaths from COVID-19. First of all, are you worried you're going to get to numbers like that? And secondly, are the economic effects of a shutdown in some ways more devastating than the deaths, at least, that you're seeing so far?
Such an uncertain virus. We're all learning. And so you can never discount, you know, whether we would get to that kind of a death rate. Of course, right now it is relatively low. The issue is, though, and you mentioned it at the top of the show, is when your ICU goes from being 15% COVID to 40, 50% COVID, you're having to turn people away who probably shouldn't be turned away. I mean, if you end up in the ICU, you want the best treatment possible. And there could come a point in which we can't sustain the strokes, the heart attacks, the dialysis, pregnant women who need to give birth. So it's not a sustainable long-term strategy. What is a sustainable long-term strategy is to bring the curve down, have that pain, of course, of the shutdown, but then reopen more sustainably and for the longer term. That's what we have to keep in mind. But I do think it's important also to take a step back and think about what we're doing here. What we're saying is that it's okay for hospitals to be stretched thin, doctors, nurses, and for people to fill those hospital beds, irreparable damage to those folks, and just not the way we should be thinking about human life.
The Texas GOP convention is coming to Houston next week. That's 6,000 people. Do you or the mayor have the power to stop that if things keep getting worse?
Right now, we've tried to figure out if there's authority that I have to stop the convention. The issue is that all indoor gatherings are allowed. And so right now, I don't have the authority to shut down these indoor gatherings of any kind. And I don't think it should be taking place, just as I don't think any other gathering should be taking place. I can't speak for the city, of course, but presumably, you know, they're under the same issues, which is the parameters that we're given.
Does it surprise you that you're in this situation now, 5 months after the coronavirus really started to take hold in the U.S.?
You know, it's unfortunate. It really is. Because on the one hand, it is a new disease. It's something we're all learning about. On the other hand, it's not such a mystery what curbs its spread. And so it's hard for me to watch other communities, other states, other countries that really have been able to bring that load down, to make tracing, testing successful, to open slowly and be able to react quickly, shut back down if things aren't looking good. And we don't have that. And I know we can have it. And so that's why I'm saying we have evidence of how we can make this successful. So let's do that. Let's stop the wishful thinking. We tried it once already and it didn't work. So it's time to move on, be proactive, and get in front of this virus.
That is Judge Lena Hidalgo of Harris County, Texas. That's the Houston area. Judge Hidalgo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We are getting new information on exactly who received federal money that was meant to help small businesses avoid layoffs in the pandemic. According to new data from the Small Business Administration, a number of companies with connections to the president and powerful politicians from both parties got loans from the Paycheck Protection Program. And now there are ethical questions. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales is here. And Claudia, let's start with people or companies close to the president who got the loans.
Sure. First, we should note that this information is coming from a federal data release issued yesterday. NPR has reported that the Small Business Administration released this list of businesses who pulled loans between $150,000 and $10 million through the program, and members of Congress, media organizations were part of the group pressuring this release. And what we saw overall is restaurants, car dealers, lawyers were among the businesses that borrowed most for these programs. That said, we saw businesses connected to politicians, including the president, were among those receiving these loans. The Washington Post, for example, reported a Trump Organization partner in a hotel and residential tower in Waikiki, Hawaii, received a loan from the Paycheck Protection Program in the range of $2 million to $5 million. Now, what we understand is that this hotel and tower isn't owned by Trump or his company. Basically, this company, they are called Iron Gate ASREP. They use the Trump name under license from Trump. And so this is how they operate. And also reported by the Washington Post, we also confirmed as well with NPR, is that companies owned by the family of Jared Kushner. This is Trump's son-in-law, the White House senior advisor. They also received several of these loans. One of those companies, for example, is Princeton Forestal. This is a company that works in real estate, the hotel business. And Princeton looked to get a loan of anywhere from $1 to $2 billion.
Wow. Let's go
through. $2 million. I'm not sure if that was clear.
No, thank you. Yeah, thank you. $2 million. $2 million with an M. Let's go through just a few more here. There's a company that appears to be connected to Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, received at least $6 million. And it's not just Republicans. There are companies that have ties to the husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi who got a loan. So did the research arm of the Congressional Black Caucus. What do we know about lawmakers benefiting?
So in terms of lawmakers, we understand from reporting from The Washington Post, Politico, Bloomberg News have said that businesses with ties to nearly 10 members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, as you noted, including Speaker Pelosi, received loans through this program. For example, Bloomberg News reported on this one case involving Pelosi's husband. This is Paul Pelosi. He is a minor passive investor in the firm, is what an aide told us. The name of the firm is EDI Associates. This is an investment company. And Pelosi's aide told Bloomberg News that he was not involved in the loan or even aware of the loan. However, this company did get a loan from PPP in the range of $350,000 to $1 million. And
yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, sure. So, but people may be thinking, look, as long as these companies are keeping people employed. Who cares? There's no real law prohibiting them from getting money in this case. But do you see any signs of wrongdoing, especially because, you know, a lot of businesses weren't able to get these loans?
Right. We are seeing that a lot of businesses were left behind with the PPP program. And that's that we don't have data on demographics, for example, in terms of minority-owned businesses. We're still not clear who has missed out on these loans. That all said, we've heard that argument as well. These loans, in the end, were aimed towards keeping folks employed, and the program has been very successful in that sense. And lawmakers are now talking about a new relief aid that could include new funding for the PPP program, and perhaps it could include some new requirements in terms of who gets them. So in terms of wrongdoing, we don't have any kind of official clarity that anything like that happened there as of yet. But it's something that we're hearing from lawmakers they want to have addressed.
Right. NPR's Claudia Grisales, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Listen to these words from President Trump, especially how he described his political opponents on the 4th of July.
We are now in the process of defeating the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, the looters, and people who, in many instances, have absolutely no clue what they are doing.
The radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists. Well, our next guest says those hyperbolic descriptions come straight out of the playbook of former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Princeton historian and Here and Now contributor Julian Zelizer writes about Gingrich in a new book out today called Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, the Fall of a Speaker, and the Rise of the New Republican Party. Julian, welcome back. And let's start with the rise of Gingrich himself. He was first elected to Congress from Georgia back in 1978. Who was he?
He was a pretty unknown Republican. He had gone to Emory as an undergraduate. Before that, he had been an Army brat, spent much of his life living in different parts of Europe until finally settling in Georgia. He'd also had a PhD in history from Tulane and taught for a little while at West Georgia College. But when he comes in 1978, he's one of the new generation of Republicans, and he was very committed to being part of a Republican Party that would finally have power in Congress after Democrats had controlled the House and Senate since 1954.
And he saw that one way to get there was to go after the corruption that he saw from the Democrats who controlled Congress.
That's right. Gingrich really understood that he was coming to Washington in the shadow of Vietnam and Watergate. There was a lot of distrust of government. And rather than focusing all the time on right versus left, conservative versus liberal, he went after the Democrats. He called them a corrupt Democratic establishment that maintained its power unfairly, unconstitutionally. He used all the language that he could imagine for his partisan arsenal. And that's how he focused on bringing down the Democrats, making this a choice between, did you want the establishment to survive or did you want a new kind of politics to emerge?
And the Democrats didn't see that coming after Watergate?
They didn't totally see it coming. Democrats had passed many reforms during the 1970s to make Washington a better place. They had instituted ethics reforms, for example, that tried to hold leaders more accountable. They had changed campaign finance laws, and a new generation of Democrats had entered, and they thought that would be sufficient. And they didn't really see how far Gingrich was willing to go, not only in this line of argument, but in the way he attacked them. They thought politics, many of them, like Jim Wright, thought politics was still going to be played by the old rules, and they didn't understand that Gingrich had a whole other kind of political game in mind.
Well, and talk about the language that was involved with that game that he had in mind, how he used words to make his point and make it stick with the American people.
Yeah, Gingrich was a politician who thought a lot about how you frame an issue, and he thought a lot about confrontation and saying things that were explosive, because he believed that the more confrontational, the more outlandish you were, the more the media would cover you, and the more the media would replicate what you said about your opponent, whether it was true or not true. So throughout his career, Gingrich said the worst things about Democrats. In 1984, he would go on C-SPAN all the time, speaking from the floor of the House, basically accusing Democrats of being unpatriotic and not supporting Ronald Reagan's efforts to fight communism. When he goes after Speaker Jim Wright in 1989, he essentially criminalizes the speaker, arguing he's trying to fill his pockets at the expense of taxpayers. And he even distributes this memo through GOPAC. It's a Republican organization in 1990 to teach Republicans how to speak like Newt. And he tells them, use words like corruption, traitor, sick, radical, as a way to describe your opponent. So language was essential to him, in large part because the right language would get you the attention that he needed.
Well, and speaking of attention, of course, the media was essential to him as well. He was rising just as cable TV was in its infancy. You mentioned C-SPAN. Here he was in January 1986 on the House floor talking about the federal deficit, carried live by C-SPAN.
We can do the job. We can pass the bills. We can work it out with the president so that before October 1, we have put in place the kind of sound, defensible, realistic program that, in fact, the country deserves, that the Congress owes them. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Now, that speech was delivered to an empty House chamber, but you can't see that on C-SPAN because, as Gingrich knew, they only had the camera on the person who was speaking, but he knew that people were watching, and he turned it into a battleground. Here's a moment that features then-House Speaker Tip O'Neill, the Democrat, in May of 1984.
My personal opinion is this. You deliberately stood on that well before an emptied house and challenged these people, and you challenged their Americanism. And it's the lowest thing that I've ever seen in my 32 years in Congress.
Mr. Speaker, if I may reclaim my time, let me say, first of all,
Mr. Speaker, I move we take the Speaker's words down.
That was a stunning rebuke for Tip O'Neill, and it was just what Gingrich wanted. He wanted to goad Democrats into responding to his attacks.
That's exactly right. That was called Cam Scam. This was one of his first big moments in Washington, and he and a group of Republicans had gone on every night and made these blistering speeches about specific Democrats, and viewers didn't know the chamber was empty. So when Democrats didn't respond to the charges, it looked like they were guilty. And then when Speaker Tip O'Neill turns the cameras on the chamber and shows it's empty, and when he makes that speech about Gingrich, Gingrich doesn't stop. He says, look, this is my point. They're corrupt. And then the kind of icing on the cake was that all of the national news networks covered this story. And for the first time, because of the confrontation, Gingrich was on national television, and he really arrived as a figure. So he understood how to play the whole news cycle in that story of Cam Scam incredibly well.
And he brought down a speaker, as you write in this book, and you mentioned Jim Wright. So let's talk about him. How did Gingrich take him down and why?
Jim Wright replaces or succeeds Tip O'Neill as speaker in 1987. He's an old school Texas Democrat, believed in the social safety net. He was not a dove, but he also believed in restraint overseas, especially after Vietnam. Gingrich picks up on stories that had emerged in the national and Texas press about Wright, and there were lots of different stories, too, he really hones in on. One, Wright sold these books that he published in bulk to groups before he spoke to them, which was not an ethical violation. It didn't break the law, but it didn't look so good. And two, there were these stories that Wright had been in business with a real estate developer back in his district. Again, not unethical, not illegal. But Gingrich took these stories and he blows them up. He says, this is proof that Wright is the most corrupt speaker in American history. And he whips Washington up into a frenzy. And Wright is caught off guard. He thinks, he calls Gingrich a gadfly, says you just have to swat him away. But Wright is wrong. The Ethics Committee launches an investigation, and before they're finished, Wright is under pressure to resign from his position, which he does. And it's because of this that Republicans decide to elect Gingrich, who was seen as this bomb thrower who you stayed away from, into a leadership position, to becoming House Minority Whip, which was his path to becoming Speaker.
Well, and here's a little bit of Wright's resignation speech on May 31st, 1989.
All of us in both political parties must resolve to bring this period of mindless cannibalism to an end. There's been enough of it.
Julian, how much of the politics that we see today, and I think people would be forgiven for calling some of it mindless cannibalism, is directly drawn from what Newt Gingrich did back in the 80s?
I think a lot of it. I think the prioritization of partisanship over governance, which was a big decision within the Republican Party when Gingrich becomes the leader, it lasts through this day. And Jim Wright thought by sacrificing himself, by making that speech and issuing that warning, that it would stop. Gingrich had no intention of stopping. And more importantly, the Republicans embraced his tactics. And you've seen several generations of Republicans, the Tea Party generation that comes to Washington in 2010, and now Donald Trump in the presidency, that have gone according to the Gingrich playbook. So I really think you see the origins of this, not just partisan era, but fierce institution-destroying partisanship that I think the Republicans embraced more than the Democrats. It started in the 1980s and stays with us right through this day.
That's Julian Zelizer, whose new book is Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of the New Republican Party. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Julian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Dakota Access Pipeline will soon run dry after a federal judge ordered it to shut down for environmental review. The judge said the Army Corps of Engineers failed to answer big questions about the risk of oil spills when it approved the original federal permits for the project. Native American activists and others have protested the pipeline for years, even after it started moving oil in June 2017. That includes Linda Black Elk, an ethnobotanist and a member of the Catawba Nation who works on the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota. We first spoke with her more than 3 years ago during the Standing Rock protests. Linda, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
So back in 2016, you told me about protesters coming down with hypothermia, suffering broken bones during these protests. So today, after this decision to drain the pipeline, do you feel like that sacrifice that you and others made was worth it?
Absolutely. There's no doubt that everything we've gone through, even in the time since, because we've all been experiencing various levels of trauma and anger, frustration since then, but it's all been worth it.
Anger and frustration because the pipeline is under operation, 500,000 barrels of oil every day since 2007. I should point out, with no major spills either. And the company that manages it, Energy Transfer, says that oil's now going to have to be moved by rail cars, which has other environmental risks. Do you think it's possible that this ruling just kind of opened up new problems?
Well, I think that the fossil fuels industry creates all sorts of problems with all the various ways that it moves oil across our traditional lands. And I am actually really happy about this ruling because at least we will have a voice in the way this oil and this pipeline impacts our water, but not just our water, our land. As an ethnobotanist, of course, our traditional foods and medicines are really important to me, and a potential leak threatens that.
The company also says that tribal governments could lose out on a lot of money in taxes and royalties if the pipeline closes. You say what?
I say that our environment is more important than economics.
Hmm. So there's going to be an appeal, as I'm sure you know, and once the environmental review is over, this is the review that the judge ordered, once that's complete, the pipeline could flow again. So are you hopeful or worried about the future? What's next?
I would say that we are extremely hopeful. A lot of folks didn't think we would make it this far. But now, we have that voice. We have that environmental review, which should have been done in the first place. And I think that a lot of us would not have been as angry or as adamant about, stopping the pipeline if we had had that full environmental review to begin with.
So there has been no major spills yet. That doesn't give you any comfort?
Not at all. No, we have a saying when it comes to pipelines, it's not if, but when. The pipeline's only been in operation for a couple of years. All pipelines leak eventually.
All right. Linda Black Elk, who protested with the Standing Rock Sioux against the Dakota Access Pipeline, celebrating a decision by a federal judge to shut it down for further environmental review. Linda, thanks for your time, as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today is Blackout Day 2020, when many Americans are planning to keep their wallets shut unless it's to spend money at Black-owned businesses. The purpose of the day is to highlight the spending power of Black Americans, estimated to be about $1.3 trillion a year. That's about the entire GDP of Australia. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on member station VPM. And Robin, tell us more about Blackout Day 2020. Who's organizing this?
It's said to have emanated from the social media appeals of Calvin Martyr, who's an activist in Texas. He took to YouTube earlier in the spring. I'm quoting him. If we get enough Black people, all Black people, we can unite like they did in Montgomery, Alabama, where not one single Black person rode a bus, he said in that video. That right there is what caused the civil rights legislation to come. And you've seen all sorts of people pile on, and it's definitely been trending.
Well, people piling on and companies piling on as well, right? Not just Black Americans are participating in this, but other allies as well.
That's right. It's the multiplier effect and the virality, I think, of social media. The idea here is to demonstrate that, if you will, that Black wallets also matter. You take the spending of people of color for granted at your own power. Peril. So one very high profile ally was Netflix, which is depositing 100 million of its cash in Black owned banks. I learned that there are only 21 Black owned banks in the U.S. and they're predominantly located in communities of color and capital in strain. So you can imagine how much that would help downstream.
Now, when we talk about downstream, we talk about Black owned businesses in this country. How have they been faring in general during the pandemic?
There was a recent report in the National Bureau of Economic Research that the number of Black business owners actively working, that plummeted 41% from February to April. And that was a loss of about 450,000 Black business owners. That is massive. So, active white business owners, that clip dropped at 17%. And I think it underscores how fragile that community is. The gains were so short-lived and they were going to disproportionately take the hit of a depression like this.
Well, we've also heard that because many Black-owned businesses are small and maybe only have a few employees, they haven't been able to take advantage of the PPP loans like larger companies.
That's right. But I will say that even though you could dispel those numbers and say that they're small and they're penny ante, the moral suasion is huge, Jeremy. You look at NASCAR and the Confederate flag. You look at Aunt Jemima and Cream of Wheat finally relenting on their iconography. So the allies in this community give that movement a huge multiplier effect.
Robin Farzad, thank you.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, a 7-year-old girl was shot and killed in Chicago, a headline that got lost in a wave of pandemic news. In fact, it's been a particularly violent summer in Chicago. In June, 562 people in the city were shot. But the groups trying to keep the violence down say there are signs their efforts are working. Patrick Smith of member station WBEZ has this report.
On a Wednesday in mid-June, a group of about 8 guys were hanging out on a corner on Chicago's west side. They're talking, joking, drinking bottled water from a cooler on the sidewalk. 3 of them have gray shirts on with the word Peacekeeper on the back. Ed Harris, Cornell Graham, and Larice Nelson.
We all peacekeepers. We basically step in and stop any confrontation that we see could grow and be something bigger.
These guys are essentially the first rung on a violence prevention ladder the city is trying to build up. Harris, Graham, and Nelson are all from this neighborhood. Their lives and their bodies have all been torn by gun violence. All 3 of them have been shot in the last few years. Harris, while he was walking up to his house, that's just a few blocks away.
I was walking in the house, somebody just jumped out of the car shooting.
Were they aiming for you, you think?
Definitely. I got shot 13 times.
I don't want to dwell on your past, but would you say you guys were at one point kind of part of the problem out here or no?
I don't got no comment on that. I don't know. It's a crazy, it's just how you got to, we adapting. I don't know.
You say you have to kind of survive or get by over here. Is that like you had to carry a gun?
Nelson shakes his head. It's clear he doesn't want to answer that question on tape. Graham jumps in.
Well, because this situation, if you got shot and you scared, what would you think of doing? If you got to come outside, you can't stay in the house your whole life. I ain't saying carry a gun, I'm just saying, what would you think of doing? You got shot, you don't know who going to pull up shooting, you don't know what's going to happen. Sometimes you got to protect yourself.
Now, these three get paid a stipend, about $400 a week, to stand out here and try and keep the peace. Mostly, their job is to keep the guys they know, the guys they hang out with, from shooting.
Like, only can stop our people from doing stuff. We can't stop the next people from doing nothing.
It's a small goal, but the people behind it say it's a necessary first step to build real, lasting peace. And they say it's already helped prevent this terrible summer from being even worse. An example. A few weeks ago, some young guys from another neighborhood came through the intersection throwing up gang signs. It's the sort of thing that can prompt a shooting. This time, it led to a phone call and an apology.
Yeah, they came and they were just being disrespectful, basically somewhere they weren't supposed to be. Somebody could have followed them down or wherever they was from, and you know what I'm saying? But instead, we called our outreach workers and told them, like, man, tell them it's been peaceful, keep it peaceful. And they called them, and they called and apologized, and they talked to their people. That never happened again.
A conversation first before shots get fired is exactly what we need to happen.
Jalen Arthur with the violence prevention group Chicago CRED says that incident is exactly how his program was designed to work. Peacekeepers with close ties to rival gangs holding their own people down.
Now they have what they see as opposition coming into the area. They could easily just start shooting and whatever, you know what I mean? But instead, because of the way we have it set up, there's a line of communication.
Harris, Graham, and Nelson are part of a program focused on so-called violence hotspots around Chicago. There are 75 corners around the city where CRED is paying people to stand out and keep the peace. It's called the FLIP program, and Arthur is its architect. He says the goal is to start by getting rival factions on defense. He's not even talking about convincing groups to put the guns down, just trying to get them to stay on their own turf.
The thing is, though, we already know it's a lot of loss on all sides of the equation. It's hard for a lot of people to shake those losses. And so the reality is, it's not like everything's just going to stop instantly overnight. We got communities and hotspots that haven't gone a day or a week without a shooting. You go a week without a shooting, we can go 2 weeks. We go 2 weeks, we can go 3 weeks. We go 3 weeks, we can go a month.
Summer in Chicago has been unusually violent, even for a city that averages around 500 murders a year. One weekend in the middle of June, more than 100 people were shot throughout Chicago, 13 of them killed. Jalen Arthur sent me a map of the shootings from that weekend.
Oh, here we go. I'm looking at it now.
Okay. So let me show you something real quick. We just had this super violent weekend.
The map shows most of the violence happened away from the hotspots where the peacekeepers were working. It's not exactly a scientific study, but it gives Arthur some hope. He says they are meeting with their street outreach teams, trying to find ways to expand their presence. But without more resources, Arthur says, that's a difficult task. On the Thursday after that horribly violent weekend, anti-violence worker Chris Patterson is talking with a woman whose son was one of the 100 people shot in that two-day period. He's in the hospital now, she says, and there's still a possibility he could end up paralyzed. If he recovers, she says she'll have a dilemma. Her son will find out who shot him. Patterson is urging her to seek peace, but she tells him that she may want her son to seek vengeance. She's angry, and Patterson can't convince her to give up the idea of revenge before she leaves to catch a ride home. Patterson says he understands where she's coming from.
Once violence affects you, you can't forget it, right? And so now violence becomes an option.
It was a delicate balance for Patterson, trying to empathize with her grief and anger while trying to talk her down.
You know, part of her conversation was like, yeah, part of me wants to seek retaliation, but the other part of me doesn't want to lose everything that we've gotten. I don't want to lose my son. I don't want to lose my daughter. These are coming at some of the things she was saying. And that's natural. That's normal. Like when people lose people who are close to them, an array of feelings may arise, right? It could be people who are caught in the cycle of violence. Violence makes sense for them. That's the way they answer their problems.
It reminds me of something Graham, Nelson, and Harris told me. People call the violence senseless, but often there's real reasons behind it, they say. Vengeance. Righteous anger. After I talk with Patterson, I drive to the corner where the guys are stationed. They are not up for talking. They, too, were directly affected by the rash of violence over that previous weekend. One of their friends was killed. Obviously, they are grieving. But there's something else. There's a tension in the air, or at least I imagine there is. Patterson explained to me that with the killing of another friend, Graham and Nelson and Harris and everyone else out here is back to being hyper-vigilant, heads on a swivel, constantly looking out for the danger coming around the corner. It's trauma, happening right now, to these guys who are supposed to help keep the peace. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Smith.
TikTok said today it will stop operating in Hong Kong. The company follows Facebook, Google, and Twitter, all protesting the new security law passed by China to take more control over Hong Kong and tamp down on the pro-democracy movement there. I spoke earlier today with the BBC's Stephen McDonnell on Skype from Beijing, and I asked him about the significance of TikTok's decision.
The news came out that this was happening, and there we all are scratching our heads, wondering, why are they doing this? I mean, they're a Chinese company, and when the state security police come to them and say, can you provide us with the details of these users who may have been singing the Hong Kong independence song in a video or chanting something to do with, you know, liberate Hong Kong, et cetera, they're stuck in a pretty difficult position as a company because their brand is gone if they just start handing this stuff over straight away to the authorities in Hong Kong. So I think what they've done is they decided the best thing they can do is just get out of there. And it may seem like a big move, but what's much more important to them is the US market. And they're worried that if they are seen to be assisting in any way with this new state security law, that the US government might just follow India's lead and ban TikTok in the US.
Let's talk about the coronavirus, because President Trump has started calling it the Kung Flu. He has long been calling it the China virus. But in China, coronavirus isn't really spreading anywhere near like it is across the United States right now. How is that being reported in China?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, people see these outrageous comments from the US president, and he's been accused of stirring up racist sentiment in the United States and that type of thing by commentators here. But it is interesting, you know, here in Beijing, we've just had a sort of an outbreak. It came from a wholesale market. And within a bit over a month, it's been brought under control. Today, we had the first day with zero new cases again, according to official figures. Now, let's just acknowledge the fact that those official figures may not be catching all the cases. Nevertheless, it does seem to have been brought under control. And so I think that the Chinese government feels it has a good story to tell in its handling of the coronavirus, despite the fact that this is where all the first clusters were. And so without really rubbing it in terms of the handling of the US government, they just tend to put it up there on the television. There you go. How are we all going? Well, that's how we're going here in China. How's the US going? And just show the numbers, show the unfolding emergency there. And when you talk to ordinary people in the streets, they're very critical of the US government's handling of it. And they, I suppose, can't quite understand why the US hasn't been able to handle it as well as they have here.
What about the overall relationship right now between the United States and China? We've had the trade war going on for some time. Then, of course, came the coronavirus, which the president has blamed on China. How is the overall relationship right now between President Xi and President Trump and the two countries in general?
You know, interestingly, in terms of Xi Jinping and Donald Trump, Xi Jinping never personally criticizes Donald Trump, and you'll notice Donald Trump doesn't do it with him either. And so it's almost like the two countries have isolated them and their relationship, that it can be maintained in some way. Beyond that, though, I mean, the relationship is pretty toxic. They're throwing mud back and forth. And lately, the Chinese government's been giving as good as it gets. You know, we've heard these conspiracy theories coming out of the United States regarding the origins of the coronavirus. Well, the response from the Chinese government, rather than just sort of to downplay this or ignore it, has been to throw around their own conspiracy theories. And so we have diplomats, for example, raising the possibility that all this came from a U.S. serviceman, because they had these sort of military games back in Wuhan at the end of last year, and they think that's where it all came from. Or maybe it came from a biological weapons facility controlled by the American military. So they're just doing this because they feel like they're getting the same from the U.S. side. And so there's this new concept. It's known as wolf warrior diplomacy. Now, where it comes from is a movie. There's this sort of patriotic military movie here. Well, now you get these Chinese diplomats. They're out there on Twitter and other social media platforms defending China very brazenly, throwing around kind of smart aleck language, abusing other countries. And the main target has been the United States. And I think, again, this also filters down to the general population in China. You hear people in the streets abusing other countries, being a bit more nationalistic in their approach. And when you mix up this sort of nationalism with a lot of ignorance about what's really going on because of the way the media is controlled here, you know, it can be a pretty toxic and dangerous combination.
That's the BBC's Stephen McDonnell joining us from Beijing. Stephen, thank you.
No worries. Good to talk to you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.